Welcome to the What's Your Weird Story podcast.
Everyone has at least one good story.
And some of us have stories that are just to the left of normal.
We're interested in the ones that push the boundaries of what we can perceive.
Stories that defy explanations.
Stories with an air of mystery.
Stories we might not share.
For fear of being thought of differently.
But don't worry. We're all friends here. So, what's your weird story?
Hello, Weirdsville. Welcome to the What's Your Weird Story podcast. Hope everyone is staying warm on these cold, blustery days that we have here in late January. I know that I've been trying to keep myself warm. It's been cold down where I am. It's even colder in other places of the country, and I know that because I spoke to my mother-in-law this morning, and she said it was -2 in Milwaukee, so that's freaking cold. I am one of your hosts, Barry Johnston, and with me as always, my co-host, the professor, Mr. Adam Beebe. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you very much. I think I'm a little bit under the weather, but I'm all right. Otherwise, I think there's a little bit. I just noticed it even in my own voice, but I think I'm doing pretty good. It's cold here in the nasty in the great city of Cincinnati. Today's high is, I think, 14.
Wow.
Chilly.
Wow.
Chilly out there.
Yeah. It was, I think it was 19 here this morning. I think it's up to 30 maybe now, but yeah.
Well, man, let me tell you, dude, it's scorching hot compared to this morning. It's over doubled in the heat in the degrees, because it was 6 when I woke up.
Wow.
Not a.m. degrees Fahrenheit. It was wow. 6 a.m. Yeah, so we've doubled in plus in temperature.
Yeah. But, 'tis the season, man.
It is indeed. But you know what? I love it. I'm not complaining a single bit. You know, I would I'd be out in it, if I wasn't here in studio in Weirdsville with you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I had a pretty crazy week, had a good week, but it was a busy, crazy week. We did a pretty big installation at a, it's like kind of the ultimate man cave up in Oklahoma. And we have a friend that he built a place and wants to Airbnb it, and it would be like a place to bring folks to have a big party. And so we did, there's 12 TVs in this place, 12 TVs. There's a, out of those 12, four of them make up a big video wall. There are four 65 inch TVs that are put together in a square. And then a sound system that you would have in a decent sized club. I mean, it's like rocking. And on the outside, we hung speakers on the outside. We hung speakers on the inside, and it's pretty. It's impressive. It's amazing. I'm really proud of the work that we did. But long week, you know, traveling, and then you know, working 9-10 hour days. So happy that's finished with. Got finished moving the boys in. They're getting settled, and had a good weekend, man. We went to a really cool art installation here. It's an interactive art installation that you pay to go into, and it's one of those things where it's like you walk in and it's a house, right? And then you walk in the house, and then you like walk into the refrigerator, and then you walk into this other world of just... It's massive, man. It took us probably over an hour to walk through the whole thing, but it's like...
I was going to ask you about that. I saw that on your dear wife's Instagram or Facebook.
I
can't remember, but the three, you and your boys all looking up in a kind of black light kind of room.
Yes, almost, yes. A lot of black lights, a lot of just bizarre, just like... You just, the whole thing is you just find these little nooks and crannies to get into, and like one part you can like, you can go through the washing machine, you know, and it takes you down a tunnel, and just weird stuff. It was just, and that one part of the, it looks like they have shows in there or something, discos, something, because it's like a room with like a bunch of lights, and then they've got a really nice sound system and a stage. So I'm pretty sure that they do stuff in there, like they have, you know, like DJs play or something. But it was cool, man. We had a really good time. And anybody that has the opportunity to do something like you should like that, you should do it, because I was like, I don't know how this is going to be, but it was so cool, man. It was really well worth it, man.
Dude, that's awesome. I like when you can get find places like that. They're really fun. They're mysterious.
Yes.
They're really ignite imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, really kinda. Everything you can think of, like, and not think of, like, they just, it was like, it was walking into a different world. And I was just thinking, like, the whole time, how much time that would have taken to put all this together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All the rooms that they've got, all the artwork. And it's just, yeah, it's really, really cool, man. But today we've got a really cool episode. We have a guest that we brought on. Her name is Melissa. And we are getting ready to walk into the world of serial killers.
That's right. We're getting into some true crime today. And it's very interesting stuff. And it's, you know, it's kind of in the orbit of several serial killers in a strange roundabout way. But it's really cool. Melissa's a great conversationalist, great storyteller. And we had a really good time talking to her, and we will be having her back on the future for more. But she's also a writer and a podcaster as well. But let's go ahead and get right to it. So thank you, Melissa Kim Corder, for joining us. What's your weird story?
Well, thank you guys for having me. I'm super excited to be here. And especially the fact that I get to talk about weird stuff. It brings me so much joy.
Awesome. So fun.
So I love this because I was so reluctant to share this years ago, but it's turned into like the thing that's propelled my work that today. So I'm going to go back to when I was probably about 8 years old. And we used to do this thing in school where we would do show and tell, where you would bring something in and talk about it.
Yeah.
And all the other kids in class would like talk about their pets, you know, or what their parents did for a living. And they would show a picture of the pet or the parent or whatever. And I remember getting in trouble because I brought in an article about body parts that were found in the river down the street from my house.
Wow. Wow.
I don't show and tell. It's a current event. So I bring it into school and I'm all serious about it, and I'm reading it and I'm holding it up, and it's like detectives with legs that they found in the water. And so I'm sharing the story, and I honestly don't remember the reaction of the teacher or the kids. All I know is my mom sat me down a little bit later to have a little chat with me and was like, listen, I know that this is interesting, fascinating, and all of that, but not everybody thinks so. And it's probably not appropriate to bring it to school. So why don't we just kind of keep that stuff here and not share that with other people? And then she proceeded to tell me how there was a lot of things in the area like that that were going on. And I think she thought it might kind of rein me in a little bit and almost scare me, but in a healthy way. But right. Instead, it just made me absolutely curious and sent me on this path of wanting to understand death and murder and all of these things. And but that was like the beginning of all of it, was this one article. The other weird part about this is when I got a little bit older, when I was about a teenager, another lovely chat occurred with my mom. This time around, I was getting into drugs and partying a little too much. And once again, I think she thought she was going to share some insight with me that would kind of, you know, help me to stop hanging out with all the wrong people and doing all the wrong things. So she tells me that there was this notorious serial killer in the area and that they had found body parts on the other side of the road of our house, down the road from our house. And that one of our family members was one of the friends of our family was actually murdered by this individual. And I became intrigued. I wanted to understand. I started researching to the best of my ability. Google wasn't a thing. Didn't really have access to a computer just right. yet. But I started studying and I wanted to understand. I wasn't excited that horrible things were happening. It wasn't about that. It was this natural curiosity of like, what makes someone do something like that? Why Absolutely. Would they go off the rails? Yeah. You know, what is going on in someone's head or their psychology that would cause that? So those two events, I thought for years were connected. I just assumed because they were so dramatic and both involved, you know, dead bodies and these different situations, I thought it was the same individual.
Okay.
Well, when I really started to kind of dive in, I went down this road of going to school for all of this stuff, learning about it, studying these types of individuals, personality, human behavior. And here's the craziest part. I went on this really long trek trying to figure out where, if I could find that article again, the one that got me in trouble in the first place.
Yeah.
I researched, I looked everywhere, I couldn't find it. And I kind of gave up. I'm like, you know what? Obviously, it's just not meant to be. I'm not finding this thing. I let it go. My mom has been long gone since, you know, since all of this. And I let it go. Well, recently, I was reminiscing with another family member I hadn't seen in 20 years. Mm. And we're talking, we're chatting. He reminds me that he was a detective back in the day. I'd forgotten all about that. Wow. And I bring up some of this stuff, my interests and all of this and that. And he starts to tell me about one of the most, one of the craziest cases he was ever involved in. And it was, there was this guy who had, he killed all these prostitutes and had left them in random pieces and parts all over New York and New Jersey. And he was telling me about how he was called, you know, he was one of the original people that found some of the body parts in the in the water. And so we're going back and forth and we're having this conversation. A couple days later, it dawns on me that he was one of the officers in the article, my own relative.
Wow.
From the thing I brought to school and I got in trouble with for show and tell. And it was just like mind blown. All these missing pieces were right in front of me the whole time. And I feel like life is kind of like that, right? You just go through this experience of you keep seeking, you keep following your intuition, these nudges, these hunches. And then one day all these pieces drop in. And I thought it was like the creepiest and most amazing way that all these things have come together. And it turned out they were two completely different serial killers.
Wow.
One was called the Iceman, who was in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And the other name was Joel Rifkin.
Who was it again? Sorry.
Joel Rifkin.
Okay. Wow. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
The Iceman. Great. The Iceman. Was he a mafia guy? He was a hitman, right? And
yes.
They've done some extensive like documentaries, or at least I've seen some extensive interviews with him. He was talking about this stuff and he was just totally like unbothered by it, which Absolutely. Is why he was the Iceman, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons they called him the Iceman, he had this very bizarre method of freezing the body so that it was harder to detect the timeline from when they were killed. But that was another piece, was the emotional part of it. The lack of empathy, stone cold demeanor. And this individual, so the Iceman, he was actually convicted of 5 murders, but responsible for over 200.
That's what I didn't know it was that many, but wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy. So
and what Joe part Rifkin, of,
yeah, go
sorry,
ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to answer this. And Joe Rifkin was in, that was in the 90s, wasn't it? Yeah. Cause I remember there was even a Seinfeld reference, shortly after he got, I guess, was arrested. There was a character whose name was John. It was the same name, and of course they were saying he's not the killer. But yeah, that was he. But he was also very notorious and like very like feared in the New York area, the same city area of the, you know, but to a big degree, kind of like the like with, you know. The not the Night Stalker, the other one,
Golden Gate Killer or
no the other side. He's they're in New York. Those there in the 70s.
Son of Sam.
Oh, yeah. Berkowitz.
Yeah.
Berkowitz. Yeah.
So and were you
one after him too? But anyway, there's tons of them.
Yeah. Were you in New York or close to New York at that time?
So I actually, all of this was in New Jersey. I lived in New Jersey for a big chunk of my life. And the road, so there's more of this weird story. It kind of keeps unfolding. But the road that I lived on has been in magazines. They made movies about it. We were the last house on this road. So we were on the New Jersey side of this road that was called Clinton Road. If you look it up, there's horror stories. There's crazy stuff. Some of it's true. Most of it's not.
Yep.
And it was about 30 miles of dirt road after my house. And what happened when you got to the other end of that road is when you ended up in upstate New York.
Okay.
So it was that territory between New Jersey and New York.
Yep.
The other crazy thing about this road is because we were the last house before that long stretch, there were no streetlights. Most of it wasn't paved at the time. It was still pretty rough and ragged, and there was always accidents. Nobody had cell phones at the time. And what would happen is if there was an accident, they came to my house. So
I was
getting the knocks on the door all the time. We had people showing up at our house covered in blood and glass. I remember being a little kid and answering the door and having somebody just freaking out, panicking. So all these really bizarre events would happen in this strange proximity around the house. But here's the other thing that's kind of strange. I used to, when I was really young, I would see, sense, and feel things. And I would try to, my mother believed me. I had premonitions. I would see things before they happened. I knew when people were going to pass. And even though all this, really what you might consider heavy, dark, sinister type of experiences, I, on some strange level, felt like our home still had this peacefulness to it. And it was almost like our house felt like this beacon of light. It's the only way I can describe it. It might sound a little hokey to some people, but think about, you know, if you're in crisis, you're scared, if you're traumatized, and you find a safe person, a safe place, a hospital, a church, a sanctuary. I always felt like them coming to our house in some weird way. I mean, the logical side of this is it's necessity. You're the only damn house on the street. But maybe to cope, right? Maybe just because I have a healthy level of optimism, I felt like they were taken care of. We let them use the phone. We let people sometimes come in. Probably wouldn't do that anymore these days, but it was a safe place also in this weird way. So even though it was extremely charged with bizarre events and circumstances, I always felt like I kind of had one foot in the world of like beyond the veil and another foot anchored in this world. And it really set the tone for my life and career growing up in that environment with these really intense, conflicting experiences. I mean, it's total contrast to have death and murder and beauty and grace and nature and water and trees. And like, it was just such a strange contrast, you know?
A lot of people don't realize that haven't spent much time on the East Coast, how beautiful New Jersey is. And, and it is like, there's nice bits of country that you get into. You know, of course, New York City being such a bustling place, a lot of folks, they'll live in New Jersey or the surrounding states in order to get away. But it is quite beautiful. I was struck by it. I lived in Pennsylvania for a little while, and we would always go down to New Hope, which is just a beautiful little town. But we would take rides up into New Jersey, and just like, I was just like, man, this is not what I, because my picture of New Jersey was always what Dave Letterman would like trash New Jersey. It seemed like every night when he would come out and talk about, you know, all the garbage gets sent to New Jersey and stuff.
My idea of New Jersey comes from Toxic Avenger and all the trauma films. So it's even worse.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's like whatever, you know, people usually just see kind of whatever's around Newark. Right. They fly in and out of Newark. So it's like, yeah. Oh, it's like smokestacks and toxic, you know, air. And but you get outside of that and it's beautiful. It's and that's where I lived. So that road was, I mean, it was just forest. It was all woods, 30 miles of woods. And then there was a reservoir over there as well. And it's just so peaceful and beautiful. But the, I guess you'd say the downside of that is it's also a great place for people to go wander and do terrible things because it's concealed, right? It's
obvious. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But you know, that back then true crime wasn't known as a genre so much. Like there was like, you know, that's kind of more of a modern thing that's happened, but like, I have also always been intrigued by the serial killer and or not even the serial killer, just somebody that snaps and just has a night where they freak out and something happens. It's that thing where it's okay. Like what would I have to go through in order to do something like that? You know, it's so fascinating. And sounds like as a young kid, you are already sort of contemplating those things and you have this sort of, you have the depth of understanding that, these things are horrible, but also the intrigue of like, wow, like how does that happen? You know, now modern, technology and things like that, we're able to sometimes find these people, but then you have cases that are, they're going on 30, you know, plus years of not being solved and they still can't figure out what's going on. You know, I don't know. I just, it's always a thing that is interesting to me. You know, in a time when you could almost get away with anything back in the day, like those detectives really had to be on their shit.
Absolutely.
I mean, they did a lot of work, you know, and you got people DNA. Yeah, no DNA.
Yeah.
Who it could be your next door neighbor, you don't know. And there's so much pressure put on them to figure it out. You got to find the person. You know?
Absolutely. It's like a needle in a haystack.
Right.
It's crazy.
So, yeah. So going back to your story, your show and tell, and you brought in this article. Had you clipped the article out yourself, or had it been clipped out at home because your cousin was in it or your relative was in it?
No, I didn't, because I didn't know at that time. I cut it out myself.
That's great. That's great. Because I can see something for some, you know, I can see like, you know, maybe like, you know, your mom or someone, I clipped it out because there's your cousin or relative, you know, holding up a leg. I doubt he's in a picture holding up a leg, but, you know, he's in the, you know, he's in the thing and kind of like, we'll send that to him. You know, like my grandma was always, and all little old ladies in our hometown would like send you anytime you were in the newspaper
as a kid
or somebody, you know, they would send you it because they had, you know, they were super thoughtful and nice and had nothing else to do if they knew who you know. Exactly. So it's something like that, you know. I was thinking maybe it was something like that, but it's, I love the fact that it was like on your own accord, you decided to clip it out.
It's
weird about that too. If I can just add this one other little short piece to this. So my husband and I were just discussing this whole thing because he knew I was searching for so long to try to find that article. I'm writing my dissertation on this kind of stuff. And I just was like, I got to find this thing. I've talked about it. I share this story. It's such a big part of my work. And when I do interviews and stuff, I just thought, oh my gosh, it'd be so great to find that thing, right? So him and I were discussing this, and when that came about, when I got that missing piece and was like, oh my gosh, this relative is a detective and is a part of the case, like how crazy is that? And so we had recently moved from Arizona. So we were in Arizona for 20 years before moving right back to this area, to New York. And that's one of the reasons that we hadn't seen that relative in so long. And so we were kind of catching up with them, and that happened, discovering that, you know, the connection with the article. Well, about a few weeks ago, my husband was on the phone with one of his uncles, and he's kind of retelling this crazy series of events. And he was like, he's like, and then, you know, she was the article, and then this person, and he's telling the story. Well, his uncle, he goes, I was there that day. The guy on the phone is like, I was there that day. And my husband's like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I was at the deli, and these two kids come running in, and they're like, somebody call the cops. We just found a leg in the water.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Again, I'm like, what? Wait, what? So my husband, his uncle was there when it was found. I would call him my uncle, but it was really, it's like a, we call him an uncle, but he's not an uncle, yeah. Was one of the detective on the other side of the family who was involved in the case. Nobody talked about these stories. Yeah. They weren't part of like anything for like 20 years. We've been married for 21 years. Not wow. once has this come up in this way. And all of a sudden, these pieces are just dropping in. And in this crazy way, of, oh, I was there that day. I was a part of that case. I remember when that happened. And so I was talking again with just, you know, from the same family, the detective, with his wife. And we were kind of reminiscing. And she's like, I remember when that happened with the Iceman. It was really intense. It was really, you know, a rough time. And people were, it wasn't like the Berkowitz situation where the whole city was feeling it. It was a different scenario. Yeah. But in our family, there were the guy that was murdered was the brother of the friend. So they were over all the time. And one of our other relatives had said, I don't want you hanging out with them anymore, to this woman I'm talking to. Wow. They're getting into some trouble. They're starting to get involved with drugs and gambling. They then got into this, that was the mob connection they started getting into, and which ultimately led to their demise. But all of these stories, they were all there.
Wow.
But nobody really knew about them or talked about them. And as I'm doing research, I'm connecting the dots. But the most amazing part for me is having these people get to share these things, and the lights that are going off, these aha moments and connections. And this is over 20 years old, right? We're not talking about something that happened a couple of weeks ago where there's a lot of energy or attention around it. This stuff has been over for decades, but there's this resurgence, this energy that's sort of like, I don't know how to describe it. It's just exciting. It's not exciting that these things happen. I always try to be mindful to say, people were hurt, and I have a lot of compassion for that side of things. And we need people who are going to trust their instinct, that are going to get involved, that aren't going to be afraid. They're going to be willing to do the tough stuff and look at the difficult things to bring some type of peace or compassion into it. And it's weird because this isn't the type of story where you feel like, oh, there's a happy ending. You know, it's like ultimately these terrible things happen. But I do think that the silver lining is that even in tragedy, there are helpers. There are good people. There are people that want to find justice, that want to bring peace or hope or healing. And I just feel like on some level, if I can contribute to that, all of these bizarre, weird things make sense, you know? So
In tragedy, it almost brings out the best in humanity. And that's so strange in this world that's when you see the best of people. Was your uncle, was he still there when they figured out who was responsible for these murders?
He was early in his career. That's the other thing about this that's kind of funny. Wow. He was like, I was a baby and I was just starting, and that was one of the first cases.
Wow.
When he became a detective.
How did they figure it out?
I have to go back and do the research on what it was exactly that.
It wouldn't have been like DNA, right?
I don't remember if it was DNA. Oh, no. He was caught. He was pulled over. He was pulled over with body parts in the back of his truck.
Oh,
he had either, I don't know if it part of a woman or whole, I can't remember that piece of it. I'll have to look into it. But he actually was pulled over and the body was in the back of the vehicle. For Joel Rifkin. For the Iceman, it actually was the relative of ours that was murdered. It was the investigation on that side of things that helped kind of bring it closer to getting the attention that it was Richard Kuklinski who was the Iceman.
Right.
So it's sort of strange in that way. But yeah, he was pulled over.
That is so crazy that you were that close to that stuff. Like, you know,
And it doesn't end there. I have other, I started researching this stuff and I started working with different individuals and through just the work I was doing and getting closer and closer to these things. And I moved across the country to Arizona and I was working as a massage therapist and I was kind of getting into the healing arts. That's what actually set me on the path to moving from wanting to like help people with pain and things like that and move into the mind. I wanted to get away from working on the body and understand the inner psychology. But what happened in the meantime is while I was there as a massage therapist, I would have clients that would come in and we were in Phoenix. And at the time, what happened is there was this situation unfolded and they were looking for the serial killer in the Phoenix area. And it turned out to be two completely different situations once again, where they were, I don't know if you've heard of the Baseline Killer and the serial shooters. Mm-hmm. But at the time in Arizona, that was going on. Early on, they didn't know they were looking for two sets of individuals. They thought it was a similar thing. I had clients coming in that had the most random connections to these situations. And it blew my mind. It freaked me out. Now, my intuition at that time, I was really honing it. I was working on it. I was taking classes and workshops and I had mentors who really felt like I had a gift. So we were working together. And one day I had this client. She had been out of town for quite some time. I hadn't seen her. I was waiting for her to get ready in the room when I would come in to do massage. And while I'm standing at the door, because I'm just waiting for her to give me the signal, it's okay to come in as she's getting ready. I heard something so like spiritually, heard something so clearly. I hear these three names, Marvin, Mark, and Michael. As if somebody whispered into my ear, it freaked me out. There's nobody there. My client's in the room getting undressed for a massage. I go into the room. I try to kind of put it on the side. We start talking and I'm like, how are you? I haven't seen you in forever. And she's like, good. I got in really late last night, you know, middle of the night. She was traveling from overseas. I don't remember exactly where she came from, but she had been gone for quite some time. So we're talking about that. And then she tells me how something really weird happened to her when she had flown in. She got her suitcase or whatever it was, but she had parked in a weird area because she was going to be gone for an extensive period of time.
Right.
So she's like making her way back to her vehicle, which was parked on the street. And she's fumbling, trying to find her keys. And it's really like 2-3 in the morning. And there's this vehicle that starts pulling up and she just got the creeps. She was like, I was tired. Maybe there's just something, you know, maybe I was overreacting, but I felt really uncomfortable and strange. So she just decided, ran intuitively, just decided to go to the street side, or I'm sorry, the curbside and kind of duck down. And so the car goes to pass and there's two people. One of them has a gun and they're driving slow down the street. And it freaked her out, but she didn't know anything that was going on in the city. Mm. This had happened to her, but she wasn't connected to the news, to the media. She didn't know. She, whole other country. So she gets in her car, she gets home, she never calls the police, she never tells them, she thinks it was odd, but she didn't think that it could have been anything. Well, when they actually caught the serial shooters, they described them as two men. One would drive, the other would have the weapon in the vehicle, and they would hunt. They would look for people in the street. This was a client that came to me.
Wow.
And so these weird situations were so bizarre, but I was actively working on these cases. I would just feel things. I would write down my impressions, and I had people, thankfully, that believed me that I could, within law enforcement, that I could pass this information on to. So in that same time frame, they catch someone, and they had arrested someone in connection to the Baseline murders, and his name was Mark Goudeau. And I had chills all through me. He had a brother named Mark and a nephew named Marvin. Marvin, Michael, and Mark were the three names I heard crystal here that day, the same day that she tells me about the serial shoot. I mean, she didn't know that's what it was, but that right. situation. These things have been around me my entire life. And what I tried to shut all this down and be like, this is too scary. It's too weird. I don't want any part of this. And over, I've been reminded that I have never been harmed. I have never had anything harm me. And that some of us get really close to dangerous things, not because we're inviting it into our lives, not because we're doing anything wrong, but maybe because there might actually be something we can do to mm-hmm. help. To bring something to light, to connect a piece. And so I stopped resisting it. I just stopped resisting it. And ever since, it's been incredible what the way that these things keep unfolding, synchronicities keep happening and right. going, here's another piece, here's another person, here's another thing. But multiple serial killers, like, it's so weird. It's just such a weird...
It's like you're a weaver. It's like you're just getting, you just come across these strands that seem unconnected, but through you, they're folded into the fabric of your life through your experiences, and that are where you can see the connections, and you're observant enough and conscious enough of the oddities. Or and how your curiosity turns up and makes you look into it more, and that just makes everything drawn together even more. And that's wild.
That's very strange. Very.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that, because I would play this game when I was before the article. Maybe it would have been right before that article with the show and tell article. I would play this game. And I didn't, my siblings, well, my brother, who was a little bit younger than I, he didn't want to play. He thought I was a weirdo. The neighborhood kids didn't want to play. I would dig in the woods. I was convinced I was a detective and I was going to find a body. And I would just dig. Like, a lot of us do that, right? You're looking at your piles of dirt.
We're looking for dinosaurs when I was a kid, but yeah.
Well, also, one thing Barry might not remember. That.
But there was something about that, like, when you just said that, it's like that was the thread. That was the beginning thread, was curiosity. And I noticed something. I would flip over stones and I would have this simultaneous excitement and fear. What's going to be under there? What's going to be behind that? And that curiosity has led me to all of these things, to trace those threads, to meet the people, to make the connection. But that game, like, I used to feel so shameful and guilty because I was like, I'm a detective. I'm going to, solve a murder. And I was like 6, 7 years old playing this game. And now when I look back, I wonder, I don't know the answer to this, but I often wonder, like, are there these just things that are within us as a natural part of who we are that are meant to unfold? And it's that curiosity, I feel, that is one of the things that connects it all. So I appreciate you saying that.
I think that you are a detective in a sense. You're a natural detective because you have the curiosity to follow the path, to follow the strings, to, put things together, to solve the puzzle. I would imagine you probably like puzzles and other things, just in general, just by talking to you. And that's one of the things I'm seeing. I'm getting from you, impression that I'm getting from you is that this is the type of person that you naturally are. That's why you're interested in these kind of, the crime things, is because you want to understand why the brain, why a human would do this, how this happens, and how it all goes together. And like a lot of true crime fans, and how a lot of true crime fans are, in a way, like armchair detectives or something, where you have that natural inclination to pursue, to find the truth, and to pursue to find the understanding of the situation and the understanding of how it happened. Just like some people are natural you know, scientists, where they want to understand. Some people are natural mechanics, where they have this inclination to see how things work and pieces work together and can, you know, go together. And just like people are natural musicians, you know, where they have the talent for they can, you know, to play or even, you know, to hear and understand, you know. So it's that, to me, that seems that's your natural, like, innate ability as a problem solver, a detector, a truth seeker kind of a thing.
It's kind of a craft, isn't it? Like all these things, it's like,
oh sure,
it's like there's a craft to it, because nothing's given to you. You have to figure it out. You have to figure those pieces out, you know.
Yeah, but the mind
with it too. You have to make peace with sometimes your gift, your skill, your talent is unique. And I don't mean special in an egoic way. I mean, sometimes, like, I felt a lot of guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. I felt something wrong with me. So I had to spend a big chunk of my life allowing myself to be vulnerable enough to share these things, to realize, wow, this could actually help someone else. Like, this could inspire someone else to be more authentic or whatever. But a big part of my work also is helping people really make peace with their darkness, their shadow, the capacity they have to do terrible things, because it isn't about condoning that behavior. It's about understanding, like, you know, our brains are designed to put things in boxes. We feel safe when we can say, this is good, this is bad. We don't anything in the middle. We can't even, we struggle to think, like, this person could be a genius, a talented artist. They could have, like, rescued someone from drowning in the ocean and be a cruel, abusive, whatever. Yeah. Like, it's hard for us to reconcile that life and people, humanity is not, we can't put people in boxes. And the personality is so dynamic. It's so interesting. And so I spend a lot of time working on how to deal with opposing things, like good and evil, you know, and helping people realize and see, like, evil, even the topic of evil makes people so uncomfortable. And what I often try to do is bring warmth and light into these difficult places and conversations. And one of the things that was kind of eye-opening for me around all of this stuff is how when we maybe don't understand something, we may not have all the information yet, we might not have experience yet, sometimes that creates fear, uncertainty. And one of the easiest things we can do, instead of confronting that part of us that goes, wow, maybe I'm just nervous or scared or not understanding, it's so much easier to go, that's evil. That's evil.
Absolutely. Because I can't
fathom it. It's evil. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Because you can't fathom it, that means you have empathy. That means you are probably a person who has a heart, like, you know, range of emotion. But that doesn't mean that what that person did or said is evil. It means it's outside your capacity to be able to understand maybe why they did or said what they did. Not to justify it, but the understanding that, like, these things aren't in boxes the way we want them to be. And the safer we feel within ourselves to explore, the more peace we make with things that are really difficult to comprehend. And then I feel we stop fighting the world. Everybody's like, we need to stop crime. We need to stop drugs. We're not going to stop things. But what we can do is really hone our instinct and get so good at feeling things and understanding our feelings and going, something feels off. I don't need to know why. I'm going to trust that.
Right.
And that's going to produce more safety and compassion and empathy than trying to put things in boxes and keep ourselves, like, separate and distant from it all.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, little soapbox there.
No, it's okay. Because that's what happens. We go off on the tangents, but it's born through the conversation. But, you know, as you're, like you were saying, you know, we tend to put things into boxes and it's wrong or right, good or evil. And there's so much, you know, it's not a black and white world. There's a spectrum, you know, there's so much gray in between. It's not a binary world where it's, you know, ones and O's, you know, there's so much in between and there's so much understanding and, you know, there's so much to be understood to arrive at, you know, conclusions to the understanding, you know, it is obviously, just, you know, murder is bad. You know, we get that. But, you know, understanding why somebody did it sometimes puts it in a clearer light. Sometimes they're just monsters. They're just, you know, born wrong. Or they've had, you know, all these terrible things that happened to them in life that turned them into monsters, turn them into killing machines. You know, there or something that's wrong with their brain where they don't have the capacity for empathy and understanding or anything like that. And they become these serial killers or whatever. And, you know, but understanding that and understanding how they think and how they work, it helps us to be able to kind of like pick up on signs and people earlier on to notice if, you know, all these things, you know, patterns of behavior are that could develop into really bad things. And we're aware of that. We know that patterns of behavior can make us develop into, you know, bad or, well, not necessarily bad, but all the choices that we make, the patterns of our behavior will help, you know, design the choices we make. And they could be bad choices because we have bad patterns of behavior because we don't think it's a bad choice. We think it's a better, a fun choice or whatever choice, you know, but it's not the optimal choice in life. So, you know, it is the understanding, and it is why I think part of the fascination with the true crime that Barry was talking about earlier, part of our, and it's, I think true crime has been with us since first true crime, wanting to understand it. It's a little bit titillating. It's a little bit salacious. It's a little bit scary, but it's also very much part of human nature to want to hear about these bad things and want to, and in turn, kind of understand the world a little bit more, so that you're have more defensive, more protective, but also where you realize that, you know, there is more than just good and bad in the world, and you've got to be able to find to figure out what it is, and that's the whole part of learning. Yeah. So I've got myself lost there. So
actually, I love what you said. In fact, you hit on something that I often will share with my clients and my students. And I tell them that I'm like, darkness is on a spectrum. You know, on one side of the spectrum, if we think of darkness as the night sky, how peaceful, how beautiful, how quiet and still it can be to sit outside, to have, you know, the calm of the night, the day is quiet, people are sleeping and everything's sort of shut down. And there is this beautiful peacefulness. You might call it sacred. You might call it something else, right? That's still darkness. We have examples of like the womb and how it's this gestating incubative space, right? Creating life. It's dark. It's dank. It's deep. It's watery. It's earthy. And then at the same time, I use the example of like the abyss, right? It's like staring into the abyss, this darkness. Well, what we see there is often whatever it is we're projecting from our own psyches. And I really see this a lot, too, when it comes to these certain situations where people will hear a story and that's that projection again of, oh, that's evil. That's horrible. Yes, we can understand that this is cruelty, a form of cruelty on some level, and there's so many pieces to it. There's so many pieces. It isn't just black or white. But I feel like using the spectrum of darkness kind of helps people feel a little safer to explore it in their own way, because even darkness doesn't have to be anything about true crime. When I work with some of my clients, I say to them, you have parts of your mind that are unexplored. They're in darkness. They're beneath your conscious awareness. They're obscured. That just means that your ego, the part of your psyche, is the gatekeeper between the unconscious and the conscious. It's allowing information to come through. And so it's not letting certain information come through. It's either protecting you or it could be undeveloped, you know, like in part of the mind and the unconscious. We'll have parts of us that we haven't even met yet. Just like you have skills, gifts, talents, things that you haven't even discovered within you are in shadow. They're just not integrated into your personality yet, but they're in darkness. Are they bad? Are they wrong? Or are they just unknown? unintegrated. And I feel that happens a lot in these different subjects too. There's just so much unknown. And if we can make a little bit more peace with the unknown, I think that settles something within us, also physically, just on the physical level. It helps the body come out of that fight or flight state. We regulate the nervous system. And next thing you know, that ego lets a little bit more through. Just like I discover this random article, like, and who is connected to, after all these years of searching, I take my attention away from searching, I let it go. And what happens? It comes to me. I do think some things work that way. I think when we are pushing and trying and forcing, it's the ego's way of trying to control and dominate. But the way the ego learns to receive better is through a state of surrender. So sometimes these things force us to surrender. I don't know what to do with this. I'm going to let it go. I don't know how to handle this. I'll look at it later. And there's something beautiful in that too, that at first look, it feels kind of disempowering, like I'm giving up or I'm, but actually, no, you're saying I'm trusting in something greater than myself to just put this over here for a minute and to give myself some space. And I feel like the times that we're in, we're losing touch with that. We're distracted, we're busy, we're on our devices. Even when you were talking back to, like, you know, back in the day, all these stories that are originating from like the 80s and the 90s, I'm so glad I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have an iPad. I wasn't distracted. I was digging in the dirt in the woods, wanting to be a detective. Like, I'm so grateful for all of that. Yeah. So it's funny, you know, our influences and the times we're in.
We are a product of our influences, and we're very good at treating symptoms. We aren't great at getting to the crux of the issue. And in modern day technology, everybody's got an opinion and the loudest opinion wins. And when you talk about things that scare you or why somebody did something, it's like, yeah, it's easy to point the finger and say, yeah, that guy or that person is the worst of the worst. But I always think, like, okay, but what drove that person to do that thing? Every one of us is capable of doing that. Everyone. Right. It's just all of the factors that led to the decision of that. And it's very difficult. We've had a lot of people on that talk about, you know, PTSD and how you deal with those things. And it's very difficult to do that work and go back through your life and have to, like, reconcile some of those things that maybe you made a bad decision. Maybe something was done to you that was horrific, you know, and everyone copes with those things in their own way. But I think that the further along we get here with modern technology, the further away from each other we get. And that's very dangerous. We are animals that are meant to be social, and we are meant to be around one another. And because we see ourselves in other people, which is which is why we are so interested in these things. What makes a person tick? You know, what are those things? I mean, you know, when you're a kid and you have the weird kid at school and everybody just, like, makes fun of the weird kid, and, you know, and you don't think much beyond that because you're a kid as well. And then later on, you're like, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for that person. And like, you know, the circumstances that they came from, and, like, you know, you see people that come and they rise out of nothingness into greatness. Or they come from that, and they make wrong decisions and you know, do the bad things. But the great equalizer is life itself. Like, you look at the Menendez brothers, man. They had from the outside looking in, everything you could possibly ever want. Came from a fluent family, but behind the doors, there were things happening to them that were absolutely brutal. And then they murder their family, you know, their mother and their father, right? And then And then people are just like, oh, they were just bratty kids that, you know, were spoon fed and had too much or whatever. And it's like, how many, 35 years later, like all this stuff starts to come out and you're like, wow, like maybe there's some substance to the reason why they did the horrific thing. Yeah, it's not black and white. I mean, it's so many shades of gray, you know?
The culture, you're speaking to the culture of the time too, that we experience these cases in. And there is a culture that's sort of collectively judging, evaluating, you know, that public opinion is a culture. And at that time, I just actually did a podcast episode on this. I wrote one on the resurgence of the Menendez brothers case and JonBenet Ramsey case.
That was another one I wanted to talk to you about. So,
right. Like, yeah, so yeah. Weird. After 20 something or whatever, I don't know how the math, I'm not sure the years specifically, but decades have passed on both situations. And here we are months apart, a couple different documentaries have come out. And it was when I was kind of speaking to that, what I actually did is I wrote two different mock cases. And I pretended that the Menendez brothers were twin girls living in poverty. And I didn't tell people where I was going with this, but I presented it this way. And I was like, "What? How would you treat this if they were saying they were abused and this was going on?" But the culture today that's more understanding of abuse and trauma and PTSD versus back in the day where it's like we're sweeping everything under the rug. And there's no way we're going to believe this wealthy, affluent individual, this family. We can't even fathom that a mother also in that dynamic would treat her children that way and know about the abuse and not doing it. Like, we can't even, at the time, we didn't have the capacity. And I say we, some of us did, not everyone did.
Yeah.
And in fact, we vilified them for being liars and focused on the greed aspect. And then with the JonBenet Ramsey case, it's so interesting because of all the different evidence pieces, you know, the contaminated evidence, the DNA was pretty much useless and couldn't rule people out. And they wanted to say they didn't go back and ask other people, even though they technically had to rule everybody out because it was a mess. But the idea came back to confirmation bias in both of those situations. There was an underlying narrative that started both of those things and people ran with it. And when that happens, we will unconsciously create a framework to support this narrative that we are fixated on, mm-hmm. no matter what kind of other information comes in. So it almost takes the resurgence of a case years later, when there's a different mindset, a different culture that can view this, they weren't a part of the time, and they can view this and go, well, what if they're telling the truth, right? I remember what were they calling it? The abuse excuse or something. Like, they even created these terrible little mantras and taglines to try to dismiss and devalue this information that was critical. And I just think confirmation bias is such an interesting thing. Like, it's, again, giving us the ability to look at our own projections of when we're filling in these pieces of a situation or a story, because it makes us uncomfortable, because we don't want to look at it. We don't want to know the truth. We think logically we want to know the truth, but we really are fixed on a certain idea, and that's exactly what happened. And those two situations are kind of funny like that, because on one hand, you have the wealthy family being seen as the victim. I mean, they were murdered, so there is that perspective. They were murdered for sure. And their boys, you know, the sons being these greedy, you know, individuals that wanted the money, the inheritance. And so the parents were not even considered to be problematic on any level in that way. But then the other side, they're vilified for it, right? The parents are accused of killing their daughter for putting her in pageants and doing all this stuff and making her a target. And it's like, isn't it interesting that we have this flip-flop of like the way the parents are treated in both situations through the public eye? And that's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous when a group of people comes together and thinks they have an informed opinion and really is latching on to things that were like leaked through the media. They take that at face value, make it a fact, when all the other evidence that starts to come in is now dismissed. And it takes a new decade to kind of, I think, give it all a fresh perspective, which I think that's why it's coming around again.
Do you have an opinion on the JonBenet situation?
You know, I'm a little conflicted with that one. I'll be honest, I was in the camp of they did it. The parents did it like early on when I first was watching. I was, you know, I don't even know how old I was when that came out. But I was watching all this stuff and hearing all the, you know, but the typical things that were all over the media at that time. Watching it now, being more trusting of my instinct, my intuition, a bit more aware of certain things and pieces, I think they got it all wrong. I think that there were some, if you watch the new documentary that just came out on Netflix, it's really interesting. There's a lot of great pieces in there. I really align with what that detective, I think his name was Lou Smith, who passed away. He was really, really well regarded and as a detective. And he kind of was working on it and on the side, but it was his life project. He ended up dying of cancer and passing on the evidence and all the work he had done to his children. And he just made some really amazing connections. I aligned with a lot of what he said, that there was a taser used, that she, you know, that it was somebody outside of the household. I don't think it was the family. I'm not sure if they were connected to the family or not. That's a little unclear for me as far as my opinion goes on that. But I definitely feel like there was something up that John Michael Carr, I think his name was, gave me the creeps. I'll just be honest. When they played some of the video, the audio of him talking about JonBenet and Patty Ramsey, and just before they knew who he was, there's audio recordings. And I couldn't discern for myself, am I reacting this way because this dude is just sick, right, and twisted? Yeah. Or am I having this reaction because he might be the person that they should look at more closely? And I'll be honest, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure on that piece, but I don't think the parents did it. It could have been involved on some level, but I think they were tormented for years. I don't think the son did it either. I think, speaking of the culture of the time, I think that one of the main interviews they had with the son, I don't remember who interviewed him, but his body language, his demeanor, his mannerisms, everything, he looked like a typical kid who was overwhelmed, confused, treated horribly by the media.
Yeah.
There's just so much. There's so much embedded in that situation.
Yeah. You know, Adam, Adam's brother is an insurance adjuster, and he came on and he told the story about he was in Colorado and he was in a home and he was doing some work, you know, going through the house, and he just got the creeps. And he found out later that it was the house. It was their house that he was in.
Yeah.
Wow.
And my brother is not woo-woo by
at all
standards.
Which makes him impactful, right?
Yeah.
Felt it. Wow.
Yeah.
So your practice, you've talked about your clients and your practice. Can you tell us what it is that you do for that, in that aspect? How that, because I'm, that obviously ties in to so much of everything else.
Absolutely. So I recently completed my master's degree in depth psychology. And so my background's in altered states of consciousness and all this, you know, investigative type of work and stuff like that, but also working with the hidden parts of the mind. And so I'm a clinical certified hypnotherapist. So I used to blend those things together. I would help people get into altered states to help them retrieve information or to understand parts of themselves. Now I do more teaching of that kind of work. I don't actually practice necessarily as much like leading people through some of these practices, but I do a lot of teaching, classes, workshops. And one of the ways that I work with the clients and my students is through fairy tales. Sounds kind of funny, but the old school Grimm's fairy tales, the really sick, twisted ones, are potent, powerful tools for understanding your psychology. And I now help them by researching different fairy tales, and they find patterns of what they went through. They'll find it in a fairy tale. And by reading the tale and uncovering the symbolism So this is all through a depth psychological perspective, and it's influenced by Jungian work. So Carl Jung, the work of Carl Jung and the shadow self and things like that. So in Jungian analysis, they will use fairy tales with children, with adults who have been through just terrible things, because it gives them the ability to read a story, to separate themselves from what they've been through, and it actually unlocks different parts of them without re-traumatizing them. And so they get to recreate the story, they can read the journey of the protagonist in the fairy tale is all about this process of individuation, which is the becoming of who you've always meant to be, right? They're on this mm-hmm. journey. They have these ordeals. All these things are happening to them. And so when the client or the student goes through that process, they have this creative way of exploring horrific things. And the creative piece all of a sudden makes it feel like there's magic again, there's enchantment again, there's soulfulness, there's discernment. We learn about intuition and how to sense deception through fairy tales, right? So studying psychopaths and serial killers has actually translated to me using fairy tales with clients to teach them how to pick up on things and sense things. But that's a lot of the work that I do now is writing, teaching, speaking around those themes. I also specialize in nightmares. And I love listening to people tell me about their nightmares and stuff, dreams and nightmares. So nightmare analysis. And I usually can help them sort of get to the source of why they're having that nightmare, why it's repeating. And once we realize what it is, they're usually being haunted by something. Something's chasing them. Something. They're drowning. They're dying. They're being dismembered. There's always some crazy theme going on in a nightmare. And it's the idea that the psyche is speaking to them symbolically. And what is that symbolic language? How do we break it down? How do we translate it? How do we understand what this amazing hidden part of you is trying to show you and bring to consciousness? And it's amazing. It's amazing. I'm not saying I'm amazing. I'm saying the work is so amazing. And I feel so grateful to be a part of it and to watch people shift and heal and forgive and decades of resentment just disappear. Like forgiveness. Like it's so incredible what happens. And I do it all through the lens of let's make peace with your darkness. Because wow. There's gold there. There's so much there. So that's what I do.
That's amazing. Good for you. That is
awesome. That's a very incredibly interesting field of study to just like, again, weaving all those different kinds of areas to pull them in together to create, you know, the fabric that, you know, that is the life of the understanding, the brain, the universe, of it all. So
it's been interesting.
I'm trying to weave that together.
it makes sense to me. It all makes sense. That's to great. Me. It's, yeah, there wasn't a genre that I could find that was like personal development, spirituality, true crime. So I'm making my own.
No, it's great. It totally makes sense.
My own, yeah.
That's fantastic. How can people get in touch with you? Do you have books or a podcast or anything that you do?
Okay. I do. So the best thing, honestly, just go to my website. It's melissacorder.com. Everything's on there. I have a Substack blog called Hauntingly Beautiful Things, where I talk about all this weird stuff. I have my podcast, which I also talk about all the weird stuff. I say it's all about film forensics and fairy tales. Nice. And it's called A Dose of Depth with Melissa Kim Corder. So that's the podcast. And then on the website, everything else is there. The courses, the classes, things like that. I do have a book that's coming out in 2025, but it will not be available until fall around Halloween, kind of perfect timing. But it's called The Apothecary for the Afflicted. And it's all these different fairy tales with these really intense afflictions and how to do essentially what I'm talking about, where you can read the tale, I tell you the symbolism, and you can really dive into some difficult territory in order to work through it.
That's awesome. You should come back whenever that is coming out. You know, we'd love to promote it.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, anytime. We love talking to you. This has been really fascinating, and I just followed you on Spotify so that I can check you out, A Dose of Death. And I know a couple other people that listen to us for sure are going to follow along. That's right up their alley as well. Yeah, this has been really cool. I know, there's so much more that we can talk about, I know, on that of drawing all these influences. And, you know, like the just even talking about how the old versions of the fairy tales, the pre-Disney fairy tales, how that relates to contemporary psychology alone. And, you know, especially for, you know, people who've had any kind of traumatic or criminal type psychology, how that affects. I never really heard that application before, but that's incredibly fascinating to me, because I can see how, you know, putting oneself as the player one of the fairy tale character, you know, how, and it is a hero's journey, and the hero, you know, the things that that person has to go through and what that can be learned from that, the whole, you know, young thing there.
It's interesting. It's amazing because it translates pretty consistently. So, you know, anytime somebody goes into the dark woods, they're confronting their unconscious. The forest, the ocean, the woods, the basements. It's so amazing because the symbolic part of it, there's a lot of consistent pieces. But what I love about this work is you're not looking in a book that's like a dictionary of symbols. You're referring to the greatest source, which is your own psyche, to go, what is this to me? How does this translate? How do I feel? Because if we give people the thing, we're planting a seed instead of going, your psyche is so unique, so creative, so brilliant. It's created this situation, this trauma, this whatever, to help you unlock the meaning here. And that feels so much more empowering than saying, hey, let's go find the blessing in this really shitty, horrible thing that happened. Like, sometimes that feels like a slap in the face, you know, especially if you're working with people that have been through rape and like horrendous, difficult things. The last thing you want to hear is like, let's find the blessing of the silver lining.
Right.
So instead, it's like, how do we find your power? Where do we reclaim power in this? And we can see power dynamics in the tales too, but they've got to be the good old bloody, you know, dismembered ones. They're not going to have the effect if they're the watered down versions. It doesn't activate the psyche in the same way, or the body. So it's a very somatic, you know, thing too. You actually listen to these fairy tales and you pay attention to the body and how it responds, because it'll tell you. There'll be a word and all of a sudden you'll be like, I don't know why, because the ego doesn't know, the conscious mind doesn't get it, but there's an emotional charge there and you trace that charge. That's how I deal with the true crime stuff, is I trace the charges. But in the healing side of the work, I do the same thing in people's psyches. I'm like, you had energy when you just said that. Let's follow that. So it's that detective part that comes out in these unique ways. But everybody can do it. It's just we have to slow down, trust ourselves, and believe that there's something there for us to discover and to listen to.
Yeah, that's awesome. Amazing. That's Let's really do it again. Awesome. We want to have you back on. Sure. Let's do it again. You know,
I'd love to. I appreciate this a lot. I'm so grateful. You guys are doing wonderful work. Thank you. Love these conversations. It's important to have this, so I'm so grateful that you're having me on today.
Get this. We call it What's Your Weird Story, right? But we don't limit it to weird stories. It's true. Sometimes we have crazy travel and epic adventure stories. Sometimes we do book reports and other special episodes. Sometimes we'll cover some weird news. Sometimes I'll see one of my oldest, dearest friends just dancing around and punching the air for 5 minutes before we sit down and record an episode. But hey, it's all good because it's fun to talk to people, to make new friends, to get in touch and reacquainted with old friends, and hear amazing stories.
Wow. We talked about Iceman, Joel Rifkin, her interest in serial killers, and just amazing stuff, Melissa. Yeah. Thank you so much. It was an incredible conversation.
I love how it started very early on for her. And so many good things start with show and tell, and her flipping out that article as a little kid, probably not even understanding it really, obviously not fully understanding
the gravity of the article, but taking that to school for her show and tell to talk about. I mean, I could think there's probably I can name a couple of people that we grew up with who probably would have been that little kid.
Yeah.
Who would have done that. And, you know, it could have been one of us. I'm not just, you know, it could have been. I mean, there are other people for sure that I'm thinking of, but it easily could have been one of us.
I remember, gosh, it was in grade school and we had show and tell. And one of the kids in our class told the story about his grandmother putting Jesse James Gang up in her barn for the night.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were around for that or if you remember that, but that was a cool story and kind of similar in that, you know, Jesse James was well known for crazy stuff. And but yeah, that would have been if I were in her class, I'd have probably loved that. That would have been or scared, one of the two.
Yeah. The teacher certainly didn't seem to care for it very much, but that's cool. You know, I mean, that's kind of, you know, I mean, that's where the seeds were sown. And this, the weird synchronicities about the fact that she didn't realize it, she didn't know it, but that her uncle or relative, or what do you call it, her uncle, was one of the cops on the case. It was in his early days on that case. And then her being able to talk to him about that case years later, and then she and her husband discovering that his uncle had a weird connection to it as well.
Yeah.
Being in the deli where the boys who found the body part ran in freaking out saying, "Call the cops, we found a body part in the ocean, water or whatever." Yeah.
It's so
strange, but you know, I mean, that happens in this, even in small towns, you know, in New Jersey, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a weird interconnected world like that. It's just so bizarre.
But and so, if so far removed from us, but then we talk to these folks like Melissa that have connection to these things that I've been interested in for a long time. I remember when the Iceman tapes came out, I think it was on HBO or somebody did a documentary on him, and they set him down and they started talking to him, and it was just like, wow.
Yes.
This is incredible. And then she has a connection to it. It's just so cool, man, and wild. And it's just cool. It was a great, again, a great conversation. She's doing great work now. She's using her knowledge to help folks and do it in such an interesting way.
Her way of combining personal development, true crime and fairy tales, and using those together as a way of helping people over trauma, and how to recognize trauma and how to recognize themselves in those stories and as the hero in the story to put themselves, you know, through the hero's journey and recognize all that stuff that's really fascinating. And it is something that I, you know, certainly never heard of before, combining all those aspects. But I mean, really, it's a brilliant way to, you know, create a new system of helping people who, you know, it's not going to work for everybody, but those people who have been touched by true crime trauma, you know, have experienced trauma from crime and, you know, all these horrible things, they're going to be able to benefit from it, you know. So it's really, really cool. It's kind of a radical idea, and I think it's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we could benefit from your stories. We would love to have you on. We would love to hear your stories. If you got something in the vein of what we spoke about with Melissa, great. If you don't, something completely different. We have some wild stories coming up from a friend who was a skydiver for a lot of years, and stories that I'd never heard about, which are just, to me, are wild. To him, it's normal. But anything, man, anything that you think is normal may be not everyone's cup of tea, and we would love to get into that and talk to you about it.
Yeah, we love to hear your crazy adventures, your funny faux pas, your cryptid encounters, you know, if something that goes bump in the night, tell us all about it, whether it's supernatural or not. You know, we just want to hear your stories. We welcome all kinds of stories from all from everyone, no matter how big or how small. We enjoy a good conversation and a laugh and a shock and and just being informed and just connecting with you, our guests and our listeners and each other. And that's what makes Weirdsville the coolest place in the, you know, internet world, podcast world. We hope. Well, you know, we want to have a little bit of humility about us, you know. But yep. We do enjoy doing this. We appreciate everybody who takes time to listen to these stories and everybody who takes time to share their stories. And we couldn't do it without you guys. So let's keep it going. We got, like Barry said, we got crazy skydiver stories. Just complete insanity for you and me, Barry, because neither one of us would jump out of an airplane.
Yeah, I want to stay as close to the ground as I can, man.
Especially back in the early 80s.
Yeah, wild. Wild, man.
Oh, but tune in next week for that. And then we've got a repeat visitor, repeat guest, who was with us way back in our episodes in the 70s, I think 72, with some really spooky, catching up on some crazy haunted house, spooky spook stuff. Man, you'll have to check it out. And so much more coming down the line. It's going to be another great year here in Weirdsville. And we really appreciate everybody who's been a part of it. I know I'm running back around, but we really do appreciate all the support and the listeners and the storytellers. So
absolutely.
Join us next time here on the pod, same place, same time, whenever you listen to it. It could be a different time, probably the same place. Generally people listen to pods in the same place. You know, if you're going to work in your car, or you're washing your dishes, or you're laying down to sleep to listen to our harmonious voices that drift off into Neverland while you hear us Babylon.
God bless you.
And as you hear the horrible, horrible stories of body parts being found in the water as you drift into sleep. Wandering into the land of Nod. You're floating into the great slumber for the evening. And until next time, be safe.
Be weird.
Sweet dreams.
As always, if you have a weird story, we want to hear it.
If you have a lot of them, we want to hear them all.
We can't do this podcast without your invaluable contributions.
Whether it's sharing your stories,
listening,
rating,
and spreading the word about the podcast. Thanks for listening. Till next time, be safe.
Be weird.
The stories presented on the What's Your Weird Story podcast are, to our knowledge, true experiences that our guests have had. We can't take the time to research all claims made, and besides, it's just not as fun.